Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Practice Group, was recorded on June 14, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on U.S. v. Jones and the expectation of privacy. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we have two guest speakers, Professor Orrin Kerr and Professor Jamil Jaffer. Each will speak for some 6 to 10 minutes, after which we'll have some discussion and then questions from the audience. Professor Orrin Kerr teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and computer crime law at GW Law School. In 2001, Professor Kerr was an honors program trial attorney in the Computer Crime and IT section of the Criminal Division at DOJ, as well as a Special Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. He clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court and Judge Garth on the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Professor Jamil Jaffer currently serves as a senior counsel for the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence in the House of Representatives and is an adjunct professor of law at George Mason University School of Law, where he teaches a seminar on surveillance law. He has also served in the executive branch in various positions and in the judicial branch, clerking for Judge Edith Jones on the Fifth Circuit and Neil Gorsuch on the Tenth Circuit. With that, Professor Kerr, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, and thanks to the Federal Society for hosting this this call. The topic today is the reasonable expectation of privacy test in the Fourth Amendment. And in particular, the future of the third-party doctrine. For those that are unfamiliar with this doctrine, the basic idea behind the third-party doctrine is that information disclosed to third parties is not protected under the Fourth Amendment. And this is a test that goes back, kind of depending on how you count it, 40 or 50 years, and has a very significant application in the modern era in the case of computer networks and telephone networks, because the gist of the doctrine is that if you communicate with a third party and using a network, you no longer have Fourth Amendment protection in the information that you communicate to the network, at least in the case of information that you're communicating to the network in order to deliver the calls. For example, non-content information, any other information other than the actual communications that a user may be sending over the network. In United States versus Jones, recent Supreme Court decision from just a few months ago, Justice Sotomayor suggested that it may be time to rethink the third-party doctrine. And so the question before us is, to what extent should the court rethink the third-party doctrine? What functions does it serve? And more broadly, how should the Supreme Court apply the reasonable expectation of privacy test? The problem with the test, of course, is that the phrase reasonable expectation of privacy can mean almost anything. The Supreme Court has struggled to identify just what makes an expectation of privacy reasonable. And in fact, what is an expectation of privacy? Is that actually kind of a sense of somebody that something is unlikely? Is that a policy judgment that the justices are making? Is it something that's backed by substantive law, like property law? Is it really about the nature of the information obtained? It turns out Supreme Court decisions have been all over the map on this question, so a lot of people are confused as to what the reasonable expectation of privacy test even means. The application that we're focusing on, the third-party doctrine, has come up in lots of different contexts, and let me just briefly talk about two of them. One context of the third-party doctrine is in the case of undercover informants. If the government sends in an undercover informant, somebody who is sort of a false friend of a suspect, the Fourth Amendment is not at all implicated if the suspect in the case talks to the false friend and discloses information of crime or other embarrassing information. The government doesn't need a warrant or any Fourth Amendment oversight in order to have the undercover agent. So that's one application of the third-party doctrine. The idea is that the suspect is disclosing their information to the third party, the undercover, and there's no Fourth Amendment protection for that. The more controversial applications of the third-party doctrine involve records such as bank records and lists of phone numbers dialed in the case of phone calls. So in a case called United States versus Miller from the 1970s, the Supreme Court said that the Fourth Amendment does not protect bank records. When you go to the bank, you have records of your transactions. The Supreme Court said, well, those are really the bank's records of the transactions, and you're effectively going to the bank and talking to the bank, communicating with the bank about what you want to do. So the records of that are really sort of the bank's recollection of what happened, a lot like an undercover agent and not protected under the Fourth Amendment. Similarly, in a case called Smith versus Maryland, the Supreme Court said that numbers dialed on a telephone are not protected under the Fourth Amendment. The idea being that when you dial a number, you're essentially telling the phone company, here's a phone number to connect me to, could you please connect the call? That is a communication between the caller and the phone company, and therefore the government can go to the phone company and get that information, just like they could go to an undercover informant. So that's the third-party doctrine, and it's been limited in the network context mostly to non-content information. So, for example, when you're using a telephone call, when you're making a telephone call, and it's a one-to-one conversation, let's say you call your friend or your spouse, the government can't listen in because the call is between the two people. The phone company is just an intermediary, not a recipient, and in those cases, the courts have said that the third-party doctrine doesn't apply. So the question is this third-party doctrine an important doctrine going forward, or should the courts overturn the doctrine? A lot of academics argue that the third-party doctrine should be overturned because third-party records are tremendously important from a privacy standpoint. In a world of computer networks, there's lots and lots of non-content information that we're sending across the network, and if that's not protected, then a lot of information in an internet world is not protected under the Fourth Amendment, and the government can get access to it. In my view, that criticism overlooks a very important dynamic, and it overlooks the proper goal in interpreting the Fourth Amendment. So I think our goal in interpreting the Fourth Amendment should be to try to replicate Fourth Amendment protections in the physical world. And when you think about how the Fourth Amendment works in the physical world, you can walk around outside and walk all the way through, you know, walk around town or go to a store, and most of what you do is not protected under the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment only protects certain things, and it protects what happens inside homes, inside cars, inside hidden away spaces. So the goal should be, in interpreting the Fourth Amendment, to try to match Fourth Amendment protections in the physical world to Fourth Amendment protections online. And the question is, what rule does that? And I think the third-party doctrine is actually critical to trying to match constitutional protections in the virtual online world to the offline physical world. And here's why. Non-content information generated over a network is really the network substitute for the kind of surveillance information that would have been available in public in the physical world. So let's say you were going to deliver a package to somebody in the physical world. You leave your house, you walk over across town and deliver the package. If the government wanted to conduct surveillance of that, think of the things they could learn without Fourth Amendment oversight. They could watch you in public. They could know when you left your home. They could see the outside of the package that you're carrying across town, and they could also see the destination point. Turns out the third-party doctrine basically says that that same amount of information is also unprotected in the network context. When the email is sent, the size of the attachment, the email address that originates the call, the email address that sends the receives the communication, those are all the kind of non-content network addressing information that the third-party doctrine says is unprotected, and that would also be the equivalent of unprotected information in the physical world. And notice the limitation on the third-party doctrine. Once you start talking about the contents of communication, the actual message that's sent, that's the equivalent of what's inside the package. So the third-party doctrine should not apply to that content information, because just like the Fourth Amendment would still protect what happens inside the home or inside the package. So I think the third-party doctrine is a very important part of maintaining a balanced Fourth Amendment structure in an online environment and a virtual environment, and that Justice Sotomayor is incorrect in thinking that the doctrine actually is no longer appropriate in the network world. I think it's actually critical in a networked environment. Of course, there are important ways of limiting the doctrine. It shouldn't apply to all information. It shouldn't apply to content, in my view. And it also shouldn't replace the need for statutes that can cover privacy in non-content information. So computers can collect lots and lots of information and analyze lots and lots of information. And we want to have some sort of limits on the government's ability to collect electronic information and analyze that information, because even non-content surveillance can be quite invasive. So we need some sort of protections to deal with non-content information, but in my view, that should come in the form of statutes, such as the Pen Register Statute, which we have had on the books for a long time, rather than constitutional protections under the third-party doctrine. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jamil.
Great. Thanks very much, Oren. So I tend to share Oren's general view of the third-party doctrine. I realize that's a controversial position to maintain. I should note for the record that none of the views I express on this call are the views of my current employer or any former employer of mine. They're mine and mine alone. But I do share those views, and I think what I'd like to offer is something of a practitioner's perspective on this, and the notion that this non-content information we're talking about, information that a telephone company uses to route your phone calls or your internet service provider uses to route your emails, this is all information that can be very valuable as the building blocks of an investigation, right? It tells you who owns a given email address or a given phone number. It tells you who the communication service provider is. It tells you who the person is communicating with. And again, as Oren points out, this is all information that appears typically in the physical world on the outside of a package, right? So you deliver the package to the post office, and it indicates very clearly whom it's being sent from and who it's going to. Now, the reason why these building blocks can be very useful to investigators is they form the basic facts of who a person is in contact with and what they're doing. That doesn't mean that that's not something that I might want to keep private. And in fact, on the internet, there are a number of ways to keep that information private, even from investigators using various encryption methodologies, even for your metadata, or using things like the Onion router to route your data so that nobody can see where it's coming from, that make it a lot harder for investigators to use. At the same time, however, this information can actually serve a privacy-enhancing function. It can do so by the fact that when a law enforcement officer is using this information to look at who somebody's communicating with, it can easily eliminate people from further more intrusive forms of surveillance, like content surveillance. So the fact that you're not communicating with anybody that's problematic, so you're a potential target of investigation, and you're not in communication with any other people suspected, might be a reason to not continue more in-depth surveillance. It might provide a basis for eliminating you as a potential suspect in a given scenario. So in that way, some of this information can actually be privacy-enhancing. And the notion that you don't constitutionalize this protection but simply allow statutes to account for the right protection of the space actually makes a lot of sense in our political system, right? Where you constitutionalize it, you essentially set the ratchet in one direction, right? You aren't able to necessarily always best account for the balance between privacy and the government's interest in law enforcement. Whereas by statute, not only can you set that at whatever society's current expectation is, you can modify it through the political process. And in fact, that's exactly what's happened with the third-party doctrine. So when the court determined that bank records were open to government surveillance because you hand that information over to your bank, Congress responded by passing the Right to Financial Privacy Act. When the court said the government can get telephone numbers without a warrant, Congress responded by passing ECPA. And over the years, that is to say the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and over the years, Congress has changed the standards under which you can get content data and non-content data, requiring extremely high barriers for content information, middle barriers, and not no barrier, but some middling level barriers for various types of non-content data, depending on how intrusive the Congress and the political process felt these questions were. And so there's no doubt that some of the information you can get through these non-content methodologies can be problematic. To be sure, GPS data, which provides a very fine detail about where a person might be at any given time, is potentially highly privacy intrusive. That doesn't mean that it needs a constitutional standard to protect it. It does mean perhaps that Congress should look at that question and perhaps change the current rules that apply. It might be that today people's expectation of privacy has changed such that they want the political process to protect them, but we ought to allow the political process to account for that rather than assuming that nine justices on the Supreme Court or a number of judges in the courts of appeals or the district courts are best able to establish that level of privacy for individual Americans. And to be sure, this data, and I'll just come back to where I started, which is that this non-content data really form some of the key basic building blocks of investigations. And I'm not just talking about criminal investigations. I'm talking about national security investigations and child pornography investigations, which are a huge area of huge problem area on the internet. So it's not just your run of the mill mafia cases. It's your terrorist surveillance. It's your child pornographers, all of whom can either be eliminated as suspects or verified as suspects depending on some of this data. And again, the government can't just simply go get it from providers. They have to go through a process that's set by statute, and that actually puts significant barriers on the government. So with that, I will hand it back over to Dean and see if we can get some questions.
Terrific. Thank you both. Professor Kerr, I wonder if you want to take a minute or two to respond to anything you heard from Jamil Jaffa.
I mean, I largely agree with Jamil's take, and I certainly appreciate his views sort of from a practice standpoint. I mean, I think one of the underlying questions here, and one of the difficult questions, is what is the goal of the reasonable expectation of privacy test? Is the goal of the test to maintain constitutional protections as technologies change? Is the goal of the test to increase privacy protections? Is it kind of just a freestanding test where a judge should be able to say, well, I think it's reasonable to expect privacy here, and therefore the government shouldn't be able to do this? One of the reasons why I think we're still having this debate 40 years after the reasonable expectation of privacy test was first sort of created or announced or declared is that the phrase itself is so uncertain. That courts, in their opinions, applying the third-party doctrine, I think, have done a pretty terrible job explaining what the test is and why the outcomes that they suggest are correct. So it's certainly understandable that there is a lot of disagreement as to how this doctrine should apply or even if it should exist at all. But one way of thinking about it is, if there is no third-party doctrine, what exactly is the replacement? So law professors like to say it takes a theory to beat a theory. In other words, you can criticize a particular view of the law, but you have to come up with some better view of the law. And I think one of the challenges here is if you reject the third-party doctrine, what is the rule that governs access to subscriber information, numbers dialed, email addresses, IP addresses, all of the third-party information that currently is considered outside Fourth Amendment protection? What rule replaces that? And interestingly, in United States versus Jones, the recent GPS case, you can see the justices, and in particular Justice Alito's concurring opinion and Justice Sotomayor's concurring opinion, try to grapple with that question. And it's interesting, Sotomayor's opinion does not say the third-party doctrine should be overturned. She says we should think about whether it is still consistent with our technological age. And similarly, Justice Alito's view is, well, there's a line in there somewhere. Short-term monitoring is okay, but at some point there's long-term monitoring, and that doesn't seem to be okay because it's not the kind of police investigation that people would expect. These are, I think, sort of vague efforts to kind of grapple with where exactly should we draw the lines, and in my view, not terribly successful efforts. But the real tough question is, if you are going to reject the third-party doctrine, what is the replacement? And on that, there's a remarkable silence from the fans of from the critics of the third-party doctrine. And usually the answer that I've heard is, well, that's why we have judges. Judges should be able to figure it out. And at least in my view, surely we have difficult questions that courts have to grapple with, but there have to be some sort of answers. The courts have to eventually say, this is what the rule is. So when trying to come up with, replacements for the third-party doctrine, I think we do need to come up with specific replacements, and that actually becomes quite difficult to do. Dean, I'll pass it back.
Very good. Thanks, Professor Kerr. Let's do see what's on the minds of our audience. Let's go to the first question.
John Roland, Constitution.org. Let's see if today we can hammer out a theory that works. What we seem to be needing to define is a four-dimensional space-time hypervolume. That is to say, a volume with a distinct boundary in which varies with space and time, within which privacy of some kind or level exists, and outside of which it does not exist. So we need to identify what the boundaries of that hypervolume are. And we can consider various cases, for example, whether email that is encrypted or unencrypted fall within or outside the such a hypervolume, whether, let's say, persons connected by a mesh network, not going through a trunk or through somebody else's carrier facilities, but just going peer-to-peer from device to device, perhaps over vast distances, but without any carrier in between, whether that would be covered or would be considered within the hypervolume. And we can consider various other things, such as were the privacy of passwords or passcodes transmitted over a link, or whether, for example, it might be okay, legal, for a government, say, to spoof the IP of somebody in order to intercept all their traffic. So let's consider some of those examples and how they might fit into a theory that defines the boundaries of a hypervolume.
Who wants to respond to that?
I'm not entirely sure I understand what a hypervolume is, so maybe I am poorly equipped to answer this question, but I think any answer to a constitutional question has to go back to the constitutional history and the text and the meaning of what that constitutional provision is. And in my view, the Fourth Amendment is not sort of a sort of free form, sort of what does privacy mean, let's get a bunch of judges together and ponder the question sort of doctrine. Rather, it's a doctrine with a certain history and certain functions that it serves and certain functions that it doesn't serve. And I think one of the difficulties of, you know, when the Supreme Court was trying to come up with its replacement for the constitutionally protected areas doctrine in the 1960s, you know, the court realized, wait a minute, wiretapping and telephone calls, that doesn't seem to fit the old doctrine, so what should we replace it with? And I think the decision to replace that test with the reasonable expectation of privacy framework was in part due to the fact that nobody quite knew what a reasonable expectation of privacy was. So you couldn't say if an application of that test was wrong. And I realize that's a terribly cynical way of looking at the process, but I do think that was actually what was happening. And so we end up with this very broadly framed test that can mean lots of different things depending on what you think that phrase means. And I think you know, Justice Scalia's opinion in United States versus Jones is an effort, maybe not the most artistically successful effort, but an effort to try to bring back the Fourth Amendment doctrine back to the text and the history. And I think in a lot of ways it's not going to actually make a whole lot of impact in terms of what is protected or not. But the idea of bringing back the constitutionally protected areas test, bringing back the focus of the text of the Fourth Amendment, I think is sort of an effort to tie things back to that history and keep the sort of this broad privacy analysis from gaining too much purchase with the justices. And I don't think that there sort of ever has been an era in which it was sort of this broad, amorphous sort of privacy inquiry. But certainly that phrase, reasonable expectation of privacy, can go in lots of different directions.
No, I tend to completely agree with Professor Kerr on this issue. And I think, and in fact, what's happened is that because this broad language is there, it opens the door to potential problems. And the very questions that the questioner is asking are the questions that the very notion of a reasonable expectation of privacy raises. And so you have a situation where, you know, Justice Sotomayor can write things like, well, you know, maybe time to change, you know, our view of the third party doctrine because it might not be consistent with what the people's reasonable expectation of privacy is. But, you know, I guess what we really have to ask ourselves, in my view, is who's best placed to make that judgment about what the reasonable expectation of privacy of the American public is? Is it a set of 9 unelected judges, right, on the Supreme Court, or any number of unelected judges on the courts of appeals, or is it the elected representatives of the people in Congress, right, taking the views of the people that they represent, bringing them to bear up on Capitol Hill, and working with the president to find legislation that can define the boundaries of what the American public thinks about their expectation of privacy? I mean, this is exactly what's happened in this space that's left over from a third-party doctrine in various areas, whether it's bank records or phone records or whatever it might be. I mean, it's one that's a moving, that's shifting even today. I mean, just over the last 6 to 8 months to the last year, Congress has held hearings on whether the Electronic Communications Privacy Act ought to be modified to address the very concerns the questioner is asking. It's still an open debate. And so the only, you know, we as lawyers tend to have this belief that if, you know, if you constitutionalize it, that solves the problem, right? And that's unfortunately a fetish that in this area it's very hard to hold on to, because technology and people's expectations of privacy and whatever it might be changed dramatically over time. You know, I took a poll of the students in my small surveillance law seminar, so it's clearly a non-representative sample and just at one law school. But I will tell you that the kids today do not think that they have a whole large amount of privacy in their communications. And what's even more interesting is they don't seem to care that much about it. They seem to be comfortable with the fact that anybody, whether the government or anyone else, might be reading their emails, and they don't seem particularly bothered by it. Now, again, a non-representative sample, but one that I think that, you know, if you're sitting in Washington, D.C., whether it's on Capitol Hill or you're sitting in Washington, D.C. at the Supreme Court as a clerk or a justice or in judicial chambers, you may not see that. You may see one side of it, but perhaps not that side of it. And I just wonder whether some of what's going on here, when you allow courts to make these calls, I think you put yourself in a very challenging position rather than the political process, which is responsive to those very pressures.
However, my question was eliciting your opinions on where the boundaries should be and giving some examples of cases, rather than saying that the question should be decided by courts or Congress or whatever. Would you recommend to Congress if you were testifying before them on where they should draw the boundaries?
Sure. So I testified before Congress on this very issue about maybe 2 years ago, and my view, which was then and is today, is that, you know, these are very hard questions, because ultimately you've got to set the balance between individual privacy on one hand and legitimate law enforcement needs on the other. And my view was, look, ECPA set this balance back in 1986. It's been modified numerous times since to address these concerns. And I'm not sure I know where that balance is today. And certainly, you know, serving on the Hill now, I don't want to, you know, sort of get ahead of that. But I don't think that courts are the best place to set that balance. So that's an answer without an answer, which is that I'm not sure I know. And maybe you know, Orrin can have a stronger view on this than perhaps I can.
Well, and my answer would be, broadly speaking, I think contents on the Internet should be presumptively protected under the Fourth Amendment. So there would, of course, be exceptions, just like there are exceptions to the idea that sort of houses are protected. If you open your house to the public, then it's not protected. So similarly, if you post contents on the Internet or on Facebook or something like that to everyone, for everyone to see, then it's not protected. In terms of the statutory question, you know, I think if we're dealing with non-content records, I like the basic framework of the current Stored Communications Act, which is that the government can get access to certain non-content information quite easily. So, for example, basic subscriber information, who owns that account, that kind of information. But that information about how they're using the account that could be more invasive requires some higher protection. They have to go to a judge. They have to show specific and articulable facts. The judge needs to sign off on the order. And so I like that basic framework. I would probably needle around with it a little bit, probably change the remedy scheme from the current remedy scheme. But beyond that, I think the basic framework of current law is in the right ballpark.
Okay, our phone lines are open, so if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. And while we're waiting to see if the audience has any questions, Professor Kerr, let me ask you about the example that you gave in, I think, your opening remarks, talking about a person taking a package from their home to some other destination outside their home and how that would be observable by law enforcement, therefore not protected. That, of course, requires, I suppose, you know, just luck on law enforcement's part or real-time surveillance, a considerable level of effort, maybe. I think if I could play the devil's advocate, what might be concerning a lot of people is that when it comes to electronic communications, you don't need real-time surveillance. You don't need a very high level of effort by law enforcement. Those electronic traces or ghosts, you know, exist in records permanently or semi-permanently, and law enforcement can at any point later in time just go to your account and have a check run to see where you've been and what you've been doing. Does the example you give really hold given those facts?
I think it does for a couple of different reasons. So one reason is that we're talking about constitutional protection, not statutory protection. So what I would say is that all the points that you bring up, which are great points as to why the government may have greater powers in the network context than in the sort of traditional physical context, are all reasons to regulate the practice, but they're not reasons to regulate the practice by the Constitution. So if you have, for example, under current law, a rule that says the government can get access to the sort of equivalent of the out watching the package go from one place to another, but when they do that, they need to go to a judge and get a court order and show the facts, and the judge has to approve. It seems to me that that is the kind of legal protection that the statutes provide, which address the concern about expanding government power. So that's one argument. It's just that statutes are going to cover this. And then another point I would make is that we sometimes have a sense that you know, anything on the internet the government can get, and there's sort of the government has untrammeled ability to find out who's doing what and where online. And at least, you know, my government experience is now probably terribly out of date. I left the Justice Department in 2001. But at least as of the late 1990s and beginning of this century, the government had a lot less power than people were thinking. And there are a couple reasons why. First, it's pretty easy to hide your tracks online. So if you think the government might be following you, it's pretty easy to avoid being monitored. Harder in the physical world. You know, you can try putting a ski mask on and maybe people won't recognize you, but you're obviously going to get people kind of suspicious about what you're doing. And so also people, a lot of times providers don't maintain records. So if the government comes along and says, wait a minute, we think somebody might have done something in the past, it's often the case that the provider will say, well, we don't have records of that, or, you know, maybe we have the records somewhere, but they're not in any form that's accessible, so we're not going to let you get them because it would be overburdensome for us to get them for you, or the government might not even know that they exist. So it's a little bit harder for the government in a lot of contexts than people think it would be. But I think the broader response is that statutory protections can solve that problem better than constitutional protections.
Okay, Jamil Jaffer, do you want to weigh in on this point?
No, I think that's exactly right.
Okay, well, we don't have any further audience. Let me ask either of you: are there academicians or others seriously working on another theory? You mentioned that, Professor Kerr, in your remarks. It sounds like nobody is.
Well, there are a lot of sort of abstract theories, but people have had a lot of difficulty becoming precise about what the alternative should be. So, for example, there are Susan Freewald of the University of San Francisco has proposed a four-factor test to determine whether data on the Internet should receive Fourth Amendment protection. Well, a four-factor test doesn't, to my mind, really tell you anything, because how the factors are applied just depends on who's applying it. And so it's open-ended to the point where you can get to almost any result. So it doesn't really, I think, answer the question of how the rules should apply. One professor who has actually been pretty specific about what the rules should be is Christopher Slobogan from Vanderbilt. And he has this very complicated framework of so he has various thresholds from relevance to reasonable suspicion to probable cause, and then he has various categories of what he calls targeted surveillance and non-targeted surveillance, and he has thresholds that the government should have to satisfy. So a long chart that he has in a book that he wrote in 2009. And to my mind, what he has essentially done is just write a statute and say that the Constitution should enact the statute. And as far as I know, others have not really adopted his view, because I think it's very hard for people to say that the Constitution means this sort of 8x8 chart, because people kind of get onto the fact, wait a minute, you're not so much interpreting the Constitution as you are just coming up with a nice set of rules that are appealing as a matter of policy. And of course the problem is, if you're going to get that finely grained, no two judges are going to agree on what the finely grained rule should be. And so I think the problem we have in the Fourth Amendment area is that especially when technology is moving quickly, you have to come up with fact patterns and rules that a majority of the justices are going to agree with, that lower courts can apply. And if you have an 8x8 framework, there's no, you know, it's not like the court can sort of stamp that 8x8 framework and say, this is for all time the correct Fourth Amendment framework. they're going to only address it piece by piece, and they'll never get to many of the pieces just because they're not going to have a full-time Fourth Amendment docket. So there are a couple of proposals, but to my mind, they're just not realistic proposals. And I do think it's interesting. You know, a lot of privacy scholars have pointed to Justice Sotomayor's concurring opinion and said, look, there's someone who's questioning the third-party doctrine. Maybe the third-party doctrine is on its way out. And to my mind, to have one justice that raises the question is you know, that's really far away from having five justices that are ready to come up with a replacement. And going back to the 1960s and 1970s, cases like Smith versus Maryland and United States versus Miller, most of those cases I think were 6-3, maybe 7-2. I think Smith was 6-3. And so that, you know, I think Marshall, Brennan, and I forget who was the third vote. You know, back in the 1970s, you had three justices ready to have some sort of replacement. If we're down to one who's questioning it, I tend to doubt that the doctrine is really about to be overturned anytime soon. So it may be that the concurring opinion from Sotomayor is sort of raising the question, but that most of the justices are fine with the doctrine. And if I could, if we do have the time, I did want to sort of say that there's the other aspect of Jones, which is a really important question, which is what I've called the mosaic theory of the Fourth Amendment, and that is this idea found in five justices' votes in the concurring opinions in Jones, that what counts as a search is not the individual piece of government conduct, but rather the aggregation of lots of non-searches, sort of the idea being if you take lots of non-searches and group them together, they can collectively become a search because the sum is greater than the individual parts. That strikes me as a really dramatic idea, and lower courts are grappling with that doctrine, trying to figure out what that means. And in the short term, I suspect that's really going to be what the lower courts are trying to answer, less than the third party doctrine itself.
Okay, very good. It seems like we don't have any further audience questions. Let me give each of you, professors, a chance to wrap up. If you have any final thoughts, Jamil Jaffer.
Great. Well, thanks. No, I think this has been a helpful call. I think you know, it really sets out some of the key questions in this area, and it's one that is an active and live issue. Obviously, at least with one justice on the Supreme Court, and with a number of members of Congress in terms of the notion of where to set these standards. And I think Warren makes a very good point about the fact that no one judge is going to be able to agree, no two judges are going to be able to agree on an eight-factor test and how that eight-factor test applies. What is interesting, however, is that Congress has the ability and has, in fact, set out similar frameworks in this very context. So in ECPA, there are different standards for different types of information and different requirements for the government to go get this non-content information. And that's the way it ought to be. It makes sense for Congress to be able to set those standards. It makes sense for Congress to be able to come back and revisit those issues as needed. And when you constitutionalize it and you set either broad rules, which are very hard to apply, or narrow rules that either include or exclude key pieces of information that the government may be able to use, that may be more problematic from a privacy perspective. Either way, it's a lot harder to reset those ratchets once the court, and particularly once the Supreme Court sets them. So I think we're in a good place now where the debate is. There's a lot of discussion about it, and I think that it wouldn't surprise me if you see Congress changing the statutes as needed as it grapples with this issue of where the privacy rights of Americans and the interests of privacy of Americans meets that balance between the government's legitimate law enforcement needs.
Professor Kerr, final thoughts?
So I think there's a fundamental idea kind of running through a lot of what we've been saying, and I think it really explains what the debate over the third-party doctrine is about. Traditionally, in criminal investigations, the information available to the government has divided into two categories. There's the information that the government can get without Fourth Amendment oversight, and there's the information that the government can get with Fourth Amendment oversight. And the real debate in a lot of these questions is what's the balance between those two? So, for example, let's say there's a suspect who's making drugs in their home. You wouldn't want a rule that says the government's not allowed to even think about investigating the case without a warrant, because in that case, they couldn't begin the investigation because they're not going to have probable cause at the outset. Instead, you want to come up with lots of tools or a certain number of tools that the government can use to get to probable cause in order to get the warrant to then search the home. So we'd all agree that there are some spaces that should be protected by the Fourth Amendment, like the home, and that there are other spaces that are not protected by the Fourth Amendment, like watching somebody walk down a public street. So I think the third party doctrine is really about drawing that line in the world of networks, in the world of the internet, in the world of the telephone network. And I think the critical idea here is that we need to maintain that same idea of there being some information that's not protected, other information that's being protected. If we say that everything's protected by the Fourth Amendment, then we're saying that the government has very little ability to investigate cases. And then we're also saying that there's no degrees of privacy violations, that sort of getting somebody's bank records is just as bad as searching through their bedroom. I don't think that's the right way to go. I think we need to maintain that balance. And what's tricky to see is that third-party doctrine is still trying to maintain that balance in the network world. It's sort of a not obvious point because we think of the information as being private. And the tough thing is making that translation from the physical world to the network world. And that's really the source of the disagreement over this doctrine. So that's my take.
Thank you. Well, gentlemen, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professors Orrin Kerr and Jamil Jaffer for joining us today. Thank you also to our audience. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.